Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Martha Nussbaum. She's the professor of law and ethics at the philosophy department, the law school, and the divinity school at the University of Chicago. Her most recent book is Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of Emotions. And we're going to be talking today about her book, Hiding from Humanity, Disgust, Shame, and the Law. Welcome, Dr. Nussbaum.
Hello. It's very good to talk to you.
Very good to talk to you. And this book is a wonderful response to some of the contemporary trends in bioethics that is a frequent topic of this particular program, concerned as we are about technophilia and technophobia on Change Surfer Radio. And I wanted to start by asking you, the general theme of your book is that there are certain kinds of emotions that are positive in shaping public policy and the law, and there are certain kinds of emotions which have a more negative effect. And I think that that's probably strikes most liberals who have a kind of technocratic legacy as an offensive idea, that they would think that there should be a public policy formation process that was exempt from emotion and that just was the dispassionate needs of the people. Is that not possible?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's possible, but I also don't think it's a good idea, and I don't think most liberals would think so either once they really think hard about the emotions. I think a liberal public culture can't sustain itself without relying on people having emotions about the main principles of the political conception. I think John Rawls put that point very, very well in The Theory of Justice. And, you know, if you look at the criminal law, which is my main topic, you'll find that appeals to emotion are woven straight through the fabric of the criminal law. John Stuart Mill said very wisely in Utilitarianism that the whole idea of having a system of law is can't be extricated from thinking about anger and fear, because those are emotions when they're legitimate, when they're directed to real injuries and damages, that are the foundations for our desire to protect people through a system of criminal law. So, of course, anger and fear can go astray, and they can take the wrong objects, they can be misinformed, they can be excessive, but when they're on target, then they're absolutely essential in supporting the framework of law in a society. And then I think compassion is also quite fundamental. And if you look at the whole history of thinking about criminal sentencing, you find that it's been generally agreed that the jury needs to have a chance to react with compassion to the history of a defendant at the sentencing phase, that that's a part of what it means to recognize somebody as an individual in a liberal society.
Well, I think most liberals probably could get along with compassion as a motivating force, but anger and fear, I mean, I think, for instance, of introducing the victims of crimes, the testimony of the survivors of a murder at a court so that they can vent their spleen to the jury and the effects that that has, or the effects that just general anger at, you know, the bombing of the trade towers has on our foreign policy or whatever, that in most cases, it seems like those particular emotions have quite negative and excessive or amplifying effects on our responses to things.
Well, you know, I wouldn't distinguish between good and bad emotions in that very general way. I would distinguish between good and bad uses or occasions of emotion. I mean, in fact, victim impact statements are pleas for compassion. What's wrong with them, I think, is that they direct themselves to the wrong target. They actually impede compassion for the defendant, which is the most pertinent thing that's going on at the sentencing phase, and they misdirect the compassion to people who weren't actually themselves the victims, but rather are just the families of victims. And what they do is make very uneven justice for people depending on whether they the people they've assaulted or whatever happen to have relatives who are appealing to an average jury who can come forward and make these kinds of pleas. So that, I think that's what's wrong with them, not the specific emotion that they deal with. And as for anger and fear, sure, there can be bad effects of those. But if you think about why we have laws against theft and fraud and bodily assault, as Mill said, you can't talk about the rationale for those laws without talking about what citizens reasonably fear. So through the years, the criminal law has operated with a picture of what's called the reasonable man and now the reasonable person, and they've asked, what does such a reasonable person fear? And the law of self-defense, for example, is built around the idea of reasonable fear for bodily damage or death. And the law of homicide is built around certain ideas of reasonable anger. I mean, for example, you can use force in certain circumstances. If you are provoked in a certain way, there's the doctrine of reasonable provocation. If your anger is that of the reasonable man, well, you still shouldn't have taken the law into your own hands. So in that case, unlike self-defense, you don't get off completely. But you do get a reduced level of offense because you struck back at the person or, you know, hit them or whatever in response to something that was a genuine provocation, an assault or whatever it might be. So this idea of the reasonable person and the emotions of the reasonable person is a very, very important part of the criminal law.
It seems like in one of the distinctions in political theory is between pre-modern political theories and modern political theories, where we have the liberal democratic ideas of liberty, equality, solidarity. But one of the advantages of focusing on civic emotion, as you do, is that we can see in many, you know, pre-modern peoples and polities that there were desires for and expressions of the emotion of a desire for liberty or a desire for equality. So it makes more of a continuity, perhaps, between our pre-modern and modern polities.
Well, I think so. I think that's right. And of course, as a historian of philosophy, I see a lot of continuity between some of the ancient Greek views on these matters and some modern views. But anyway, what I do want to stress, and I think this is something where there would be interesting continuities, is that disgust and shame have a particular connection with the creation of hierarchies in society and with the creation of outgroups who become targets for people's unease with their own humanity. So what I want to say is that, well, with anger, fear, and compassion, the right question to ask is, what's the right occasion? What's the right object? These emotions, these two emotions, are more suspect as a class, because they, if you look at the way they work, and I think that is true in ancient Rome, there's been some very interesting studies of Roman emotions by Robert Castor of Princeton University that have this conclusion, that the emotion of disgust is very tightly bound up with creation of hierarchies. So certain groups of people are found beneath us because they're in some way disgusting. Properties are imputed to them, which you aren't, of course, real property. That is, most people are smelly in the right circumstances, but it's always the case that in a given society, certain groups of people are said to be smelly, sticky, foul, contaminated, and then we have to steer clear of them because they'll contaminate us if we're too close to them. A lot of racist views in the United States had that feature. You weren't supposed to drink from a drinking fountain that an African-American had used. You weren't supposed to use a toilet that an African-American had used. And the rationale was some very irrational and unarticulated view about contamination and purity.
Well, so, you raise an interesting point because, I come from the social science background, which you're quite familiar with, but you're applying more psychoanalytic framework to this. But in the social sciences, we think of more in terms of a kind of a structural analysis of the way that people think about purity and impurity and dirt and so forth. Did you not find that was useful, kind of Mary Douglas's idea that abominations were things that fell between the categories and that people were constantly trying to make order out of the universe, and that's why things become dirty and smelly? Outsiders don't fit into our categories.
Well, okay, so I think I wouldn't put it in terms of a distinction between social science and psychoanalysis, because I use cognitive psychology far more than I use psychoanalysis, and indeed in the chapters on disgust I don't use psychoanalysis at all. I do with shame, because I think it has something to say to us, shame being an emotion that begins earlier in childhood. We need to turn to accounts of infancy, and a lot of the best ones have a psychoanalytic dimension. But in any case, the cognitive psychology, the work of Paul Rozin and his colleagues on Disgust that I'm primarily turning to, and that's experimental work, which, you know, comes to some conclusions that are related to Mary Douglas's conclusions, but also comes to some conclusions that criticize certain aspects of what she does. And I think one of the things that Rosin and his experimental work has shown is that it's not simply a desire for order, but what's a common thread running through Disgust cross-culturally is an anxiety about the effluences of the body. What are we going to do about them? And so there's a kind of primary set of objects of disgust: feces, other bodily waste products, corpses. And then there come to be secondary objects, objects that get associated with them, those properties are imputed to them, and then that's a way of, you know, making us safer yet, bounding off ourselves from the disgusting. And so what Rosin thinks is you need an underlying account about what we're anxious about. The formal idea of purity and order is not sufficient. And then once we see that what we're anxious about is these waste products, aspects of our animality that connect us with our own mortality, then we have a better understanding of what happens in society when certain groups are called foul, untouchable, or in other ways contaminating, impure, disgusting. And it's not surprising that women in every society get this treatment because they are associated with birth, with the cycle of mortality. It's convenient to say, well, women are the body, and we're not that, of course.
I'm speaking with Martha Nussbaum, and the book that we're talking about is Hiding from Humanity, Disgust, Shame, and the Law. One of the places where this particular dynamic is playing out in our contemporary public policy is in bioethics, and you talk at some length in your book about Leon Cass and what he calls the wisdom of repugnance, and which other bioethicists call the yuck factor ethics. Leon has the ascendance of Leon to the President's Council's Grand Vizier on bioethics has really brought this marginal theory much more into play.
Well, I think it is very important to discuss Cass's views since they're so influential in our public life, but I think it's also very important to criticize them. Now, first of all, what I think we need to do is to see what Cass's view has in common with a much earlier and very influential proposal to make disgust an important part of lawmaking, and that was the proposal by Lord Devlin, who in 1950s wrote a famous lecture called The Enforcement of Morals, where he argued that the disgust of an average member of society, he called this the man on the Clapham omnibus, was a reliable criterion in thinking about what acts could be made illegal. The idea was that we have deep conventions that hold society together, and the average person feels disgust when he thinks of something that breaches those conventions, and so this disgust we legitimately could follow in making harmless acts illegal. What he was thinking of particularly was the recent proposal in his time to decriminalize homosexual consenting acts between adults, and he said, no, we shouldn't decriminalize them because they disgust the average man when he thinks about them, even though they do no harm. Now, Leon Cass's view is really, it's like Devlin's in that he thinks that if we feel disgust, then it's okay to go ahead and make something illegal even if it causes no harm. But it's a rather different grounding of the view because Devlin was thinking of disgust as a sign of a breach of convention, disorder in society that's too much to take. Cass's view seems more naturalistic and maybe ultimately theological. He seems to think of disgust as a mechanism that has been implanted in us, perhaps by God or by nature or whatever, that will steer us aright when our social conventions are totally at sea. So it's a rather different view, but it comes out in the same place. And where he's taking it right now is to say that the thought of human cloning disgusts us, so we should feel free to make that illegal. But neither of them really look systematically at the ways in which the appeal to disgust has worked in society. And what you find if you do that is that there are always outgroups in any society that become targets of disgust and therefore of subordination. Jews in many societies were thought to be smelly, foul, slippery, slimy, you know, to have the properties of disgusting animals. And they were represented in stories for children as vermin and other disgusting animals. Women, as I said, in more or less all societies have been found disgusting and are vehicles for male loathing of the body. And then, you know, in each society there may be some other groups, like the former so-called untouchables in the Indian caste hierarchy. They were taken to be polluted because their job was to deal with corpses and feces, and so the clean members of society couldn't touch them. Now, I think if Cass really looks at those historical examples, it would be very hard to defend them all as examples of wisdom.
Well, I think you're right, and I completely agree that I think that Cass's our ideas are kind of crypto-theological. Many of the times when I hear the term human dignity bandied about, I think it's just a stand-in for the human soul. But when we talk about Devlin, it reminds me of my difficulties when I argue Peter Singer's ideas about personhood and neonatal rights with people, and he basically argues that a child shouldn't be considered a person even postpartum for some period of time, and that would give us extra latitude in committing infanticide. And while I find the idea quite compelling, I think on a utilitarian ground, I've often argued that it would horrify so many people and upset so many people that on that ground, you should allow it to still be illegal to commit infanticide. And I don't know. I think I may be committing Devlin's fallacy. Is there a problem there?
Well, you know, Devlin was talking about consenting acts between adults that did no harm to third parties. There is a harm in the act you're talking about. And so although I think John Stuart Mill's idea that the presence of a harm is an absolutely necessary condition for making something illegal, you know, one could still criticize that idea, and I don't feel I've utterly refuted that in the book. Nonetheless, I think it's a pretty good idea, and that is if you have an act that does no harm, you better look very, very seriously at it. I think, for example, the only reason to restrict smoking is third-party effects, secondhand smoke, but any kind of paternalistic imposition of legal restrictions on something that's truly self-regarding in Mill's sense, that is to say, dealing only with you and others who consent, is very suspect in my view. So, I mean, infanticide, there's absolutely no doubt that there's a third party involved who's not consenting. Then, if we get to the case of...
Unless you don't think that it is a third party.
Well, you know, then you have to have a story to tell about that. But there's certainly a being who doesn't consent. And I do think that it's very difficult for someone to oppose all killings of animals on grounds that there's a harm and still to consent to infanticide. And I don't think that's Singer's position. I think Singer's position is that when the life of an infant is so unendurably painful that their life is worse than death, then it's permissible to kill that creature. But, I mean, that's a separate question, I think. And there are always cases where we have a person who's suffering unendurable pain, whether it's an infant or an elderly person, and then I think that probably does create an exception to the normal rules about homicide. But Singer certainly isn't offering a blanket defense of infanticide.
Much of your book is a conversation with John Stuart Mills and his arguments for a liberal society and for a non-censorious society, a society that's tolerant of diversity. But in the end, you come out to different conclusions, or you want to ground an argument for liberality on a different conclusion. And what is your complaint with Mill?
Well, okay. I think Mill, In on Liberty, I think that's a wonderful book. And I think he really said quite a lot about why societies that cut back on diversity and are censorious and paternalistic are likely to be worse societies. But what he does ultimately is to build the case for toleration and mutual respect and pluralism on the idea of social progress. And the idea is we have to put up with these things that we don't like because among the people that we don't like are probably going to be some outstanding geniuses whose experiments in living will show us new things that will put all our lives on a better footing and make it possible for us all to live better. Now, see, I think there are two things wrong with that. First of all, it's elitist, because what he's saying is you got to put up with what you don't like just because there are a few outstanding individuals that are really the ones, and we just can't tell yet who those are. And so it's all about tolerating geniuses, and it's not saying that each and every person has a real claim based on respect to be treated in certain ways by the law. And the other thing is that it operates with a much too comprehensive a notion of what's good in human life. Like John Rawls, I guess I think that a good liberal society that has many religions and many different views of what's worthwhile in human life should really steer clear of offering a fully comprehensive account of what makes human life go better. But Mill just doesn't think about that. He thinks you can say that certain lives are higher than others, and he says that repeatedly in On Liberty. And, you know, what's good about toleration is ultimately that it makes higher lives possible, meaning with more intellectual pleasures, more artistic pleasures, and so on. And, you know, once again, I just think that's a little illiberal, and the right argument is we ought to respect one another so long as we're doing no harm to one another.
But isn't this the key problem, though? I mean, I grew up a Unitarian, and often I refer to Unitarians, and I'm still involved with the UUA, but I sometimes refer to some Unitarians as people whose minds are so open that their brains have fallen out on the floor. And it seems that there's a huge difficulty with being liberal to the point where you believe that the state and society should be non-directive about certain kinds of ideas and feelings. And your book is itself an argument for certain kinds of sentiments being more legitimate in civic life than others. And it seems like, shouldn't liberals have a positive conception of what the good life is?
Well, I think they should, but they should have a partial such conception. That is, the core values of a liberal society, such as respect for others, equality, fraternity, these are, of course, definite moral values. We're not going to be neutral with respect to those values. But those values are only a part of what the good human life involves. And they're a part in such a way that people with lots of different religions, and Unitarians, and I'm a Reformed Jew, Muslims, Hindus, and lots of other people, and atheists of many different kinds, they can all agree that, yeah, these are important political values, and then they can go ahead and disagree about the rest of what human life contains. Some will think that the highest lives are lives spent in intellectual and artistic pursuits. Some will think something else. And we can all live together if we agree on a core of moral values for political purposes and is shaping certain key political institutions.
One of the arguments that you make is that the position of shaming and disgust towards other people comes out of a position of superhuman moral superiority. But it seems like there's also, in many cases, and I think particular of Republican gay Republicans who are adamant in their desire to ban gay rights or to, you know, act against the interests of the gay community, in this desire to escape from their own repressed homosexuality. At least it's a stereotype in the public mind that there is such a person out there. Isn't there it equally true that, as you say, that about our repressed animality, that we're so disgusted at our own animality that we try to ban it in the public life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the posture of superiority and the anxiety go very closely together. And the idea being that, of course, we're all very helpless with respect to lots of key aspects of our life, our mortality, the fact that we're going to be on the waste heap at some point. So these things make us anxious about our waste products and about sexuality because it's so closely linked with our animality and therefore our tendency to be out of control, to be bound for death, and so on. And so being anxious about those things, what do? Well, one thing we often do is to try to just pretend, well, that's not part of what we are. We're pure. We're above it all. And we might then surround ourselves with a group of similar people and say, well, these are the ones who have a normal sex life, which is defined as in some way pure. And then there are those other people over there who have a perverse sex life, and they're dirty. And that makes it much easier for us to fail to look inward at ourselves.
We're at the close of the interview, and so I wanted to ask what your next project is, because you've written, I don't know, something like 15 books now, and you must be working on another.
Well, two things. I'm just coming to the close of a book that was my Tanner Lectures in 2002, which is about the drawbacks of the social contract tradition in dealing with problems of big social inequality. And the three areas that I focus on are justice for people with disabilities, justice across national boundaries, and justice for non-human animals. Now, in all three of those cases, the idea that a society is the result of a contract for mutual advantage has grave difficulty, and this difficulty has been acknowledged by social contractarians themselves, but it still does harm to us as we think more in more popular settings about why should we include such people on a basis of equality. So anyhow, I go into that in fairly great detail and then try to argue that the capabilities approach, which I and Amartya Sen have for some years been developing as a basis for thinking about quality of life assessment and political principles, does better with those three issues. So that's the one that I'm finishing. Then I'm turning to a more a slight digression, in a way, from my usual philosophical work, a book on India and the operations of the Hindu right in India. I've spent a lot of time in India. Most of my development work has been focused on India. And I was noticing that there wasn't a whole lot being said to the American public about the rise of the Hindu right and the dangers to pluralism and democracy that came with that. And so I decided a book for the American public that would talk about some of these things would be a good idea, so I'm going to do that next.
I completely agree with you about the Hindu right. I worked for 2 years in Sri Lanka and have been very aware of the rise of the Hindu right, a movement that was explicitly modeled on the fascist movements of Europe and had its finger on a nuclear button. So
absolutely, yes, and people worry about the nuclear button, but they don't look into it beyond that point and look at the internal structure. Now, of course, things have gotten a new lease on life with the recent elections, but nonetheless, the danger is still there.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I've been speaking with Martha Nussbaum. She's professor of law and ethics in the philosophy department, law school, and divinity school at the University of Chicago, and we were speaking about her book, Hiding from Humanity. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
You too. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future. I've come up with a great plan for how we can advance the cause of science. First, we find mentally disabled people who can't speak English. We need to make sure that they look very different from the average person, or we might feel sympathy for them. Then we do painful and sometimes fatal medical experiments on them. Think of what we could learn. Sound horrifying? Isn't that what we're doing every day in labs around the world to our closest genetic relatives, the great apes? Find out more about the campaign to give chimps, gorillas, and other great apes human-level protections under the law through the Great Ape Project, www.greatapeproject.org.